Cassette 9, Side 2.
Chapter 70. Hikaki. The need to run quietly kept her speed to little more than it might have been with a sled. It was frustrating. Cut off from contact with anyone for more than a day, Hikaki studied the seascape around her to avoid thinking about the possible fate of Crydike and Streaker. She would find out what had happened sooner or later. Until then, worry would only wear her out. Morning light filtered down to the canyon bottoms as she swung east and then northward. Clots of dangleweed drifted overhead, and copper-backed fish darted briefly alongside until the driving skiff left them behind. Once she caught sight of something long and sinuous that quickly slithered into a sea cave as she approached. There was no time to stop and explore, but she did take the monster's picture as she passed. What will I do if I find Streaker destroyed? The thought came unwanted. I'll go back to the Thenon and Wreck as an intermediate step. They'd need me there, but I'd be commander then, and hiding at the bottom of the ocean wouldn't be a long-term solution, not on this deadly world. Can I bring myself to negotiate a surrender? If she did, she wouldn't let the Galactics take her personally. She was one of the few who, with the right notes, could plot an accurate course back to the derelict fleet. Maybe I'd see the crew safely interned and then make a break for it in the skiff, she thought. Not that the skiff could ever make it all the way home, even if it could run a galactic blockade. But someone has to try to get word back to Earth. Perhaps there would be a way to punish the fanatics, make their behavior so costly to them that they'd think twice before bullying Earthlings again. Hikaki knew she was dreaming. In a few thousand years, humans and their clients might have that kind of power. Maybe. Hikaki listened. There was a sound. She turned up the gain on the ship's hydrophones. Filters removed the background growl of the engines and the tide. She heard the soft scurrying sounds of the ocean creatures. Computer, filter for cetacean output. The patterns of sound changed. The sea became quiet. Still, there was a trace of something. Increase gain. The noise level rose. Above the static hiss, she heard the faint but distinguishable cries of swimming dolphins. They were desperate sounds of combat. Was she picking up the echoes of straggling survivors of a disaster? What to do? She wanted to rush to the aid of the distressed Fen, but who was pursuing them? Machine sounds, she commanded. But the detector winked a red light, indicating that there were none within range. So the dolphins were sledless. If she attempted a rescue, she risked the only hope of the crew back at the Seahorse. Should she make a detour around the refugees and hurry toward Streaker as planned? It was an agonizing choice. Hikaki cut her speed to run still quieter and sent the skiff due north toward the dim cries. Chapter 71. Charles Dart. He waited until everyone had left before he unscrewed the back of the new robot and checked its contents. Yes, it was still there, safely concealed. Ah, well, he thought, I'd hope to repeat the experiment, but one bomb should be enough. Chapter 72. Streaker. From the Journal of Gillian Baskin. We're on our way. Everyone aboard seems relieved to be moving at last. Streaker lifted off the ocean floor late last night, impellers barely ticking over. I was on the bridge monitoring reports by the Fen outside and watching the strain gauges until we were sure Streaker was okay. In fact, she sounded positively eager to be off. Emerson and the crew in the engine room should be proud of the job they've done. though of course it's the coils Tom and Tisht found that made it possible. Streaker hums like a starship once again. Our course is due south. We dropped a monofilament relay behind to keep us in touch with the party on the island, and left a message for Hikahi when she shows up. I hope she hurries. Being a commander is more complicated than I'd ever imagined. I have to make sure everything is done in the right order and correctly, and all as unobtrusively as possible, without making the Fen feel the old lady is hovering over them. It makes me wish I had some of the military training Tom got while I was away in medical school. Less than 30 hours and we'll reach the Thenanin shell. Suessi says they'll be ready for us. Meanwhile, we have scouts out, and Wadasetti paces us overhead in a detection sled. His instruments show very little leakage, so we should be safe for now. I'd give a year's wages for Hikahi or Tisht or even Kipiru right now. I'd never understood before why a captain treasures a good executive officer so much. Speaking of captains, ours is a wonder. Crydike seemed to be in a daze for a long time after getting out of sickbay, but his long conversation with Saud appears to have roused him. I don't know what Saud did, but I would never have believed a person so severely damaged as Crydike could be so vigorous or make himself so useful. When we lifted off, he asked to be allowed to supervise the scouts and flankers. I was desperate for a reliable Finn to put in charge out there, and thought that having him visible could help morale. Even the Stenos were excited to have him about. Their last bitterness over my coup and Takata Jim's exile seems to have dissipated. Crydike is limited to the simplest calls in Trinary, but that seems to be enough. He's out there now, zipping about in his sled, keeping things orderly by pointing, nudging, and setting an example. In only a few hours, Tisht should rendezvous with the scouts we sent ahead, and then Crydike can come back aboard. There's a tiny light on my comm that's been flashing since I returned. It's that crazy Timbrimi NIS machine. I've been keeping the damn thing waiting. Tom wouldn't approve, I guess. But a femme has only so much strength, and I've got to take a nap. If the matter were urgent, it would have broken in and spoken by now. Oh, Tom, we could use your endurance now. Are you on your way back? Is your little glider even now winging home to Toshio's island? Who am I fooling? Since the first psi bomb, we've detected nothing. Only noise from the space battle, some of it indicating fighting over his last known position. He's set off none of the message globes, though either he's decided not to send an ambiguous message, or worse. Without word from Tom, how can we decide what to do once we enter the Seahorse? Do we take off and try our luck, or hide within the hulk as long as we can? It will be Hikahi's decision when the time comes. Jillian closed the journal and applied her thumbprint to the failsafe self-destruct. She got up and turned off the light. On her way out of the lab, she passed the stasis bier of the ancient cadaver they had reclaimed at such cost from the shallow cluster. Herbie just lay there grinning under a tiny spotlight, an ancient enigma, a mystery, a troublemaker. Battered, battle-scarred Streaker moved slowly along the valley floor, her engines turning over with gentle, suppressed power. A dark, foamy mist rose below her, where impellers kicked up the surface ooze. The nubby cylinder slid over gloomy black rills and abysses, skirting the edges of seamounts and valley walls. Tiny sleds paced alongside, guiding the ship by sonar speak. Crydike watched his ship in motion once again. He listened to the clipped reports of the scouts and sentries and the replies of the bridge staff. He couldn't follow the messages in detail. The sophisticated technical argot was as out of reach to him as last year's wine, but he could sense the undermeaning. The crew had things well in hand. Streaker couldn't really shine in this light, dim and blue, 50 meters down. But he could listen. His own sonar clicked softly in accompaniment as he savored the deep rumble of her engines, and he imagined he could be with her when she flew again. "Never again," cried Ikey. "You shall never fly with her again." The specter, Kifkree, came into being gradually alongside him, a ghostly figure of silver and sonic shadows. The presence of the god did not surprise or even bother Krydike. He had been expecting it to come. It swam lazily, easily keeping pace alongside the sled.
"You escaped us, yet now you purposely sculpt me out of song. Because of the old voices you heard? The voices from below?"
"Yes." Krydike thought not in Anglic or Trinary, but in the new language he had been learning. "There is ancient anger within this world. I have heard its song." The dream god's great brow sparkled starlight, its small jaw opened, teeth shone.
"And what do you plan to do?"
Krydike sensed that it already knew the answer.
"My duty," he replied in its own speech. "What else can I ever do?"
From the depths of the whale dream, it sighed approval. Krydike turned up the gain on his hydrophones. There were faraway, excited echoes from up ahead, joyous sounds of greeting. On his sled's sonar display, at the far edge of its range, was a small cluster of dots coming inward. They joined the specks that were Streaker's scouts. The first group had to be Tisht's party from the Seahorse. Making sure no one was nearby to take note, he turned his sled aside into a small side canyon. He slipped behind the shadows of a rock outcrop and turned off his engine. He waited then, watching Streaker pass below his Aerie until she vanished, along with the last of her flankers, around a curve in the long canyon.
"Goodbye." He concentrated on the Anglic words one at a time. "Goodbye. And good luck."
When it was safe, he turned on his sled and rose out of the little niche. He swung about and headed northward toward the place they had left 20 hours before.
"You can come along if you like," he told the god, part figment of his mind, part something else.
The ghostly figure answered in un-words, made up from Krydike's own sonar sounds.
"I accompany you. I would not miss this for the song of the world."
Part 7. The Food Chain.
"Master, I marvel how the fishes live in the sea. Why, as men do a land, the great ones eat up the little ones." William Shakespeare, King Richard II.
Chapter 73. Aki. It was a scream that curdled his marrow. Only a monster could make a sound like that. He fled it almost as hard as he fled the creature that voiced it. By noontime, Aki realized it was nearly over. His exhaustion showed in a laboring heart and heavy breathing, but also in a painful sloughing of the outer layers of his skin. His allergic reaction to the water seemed to be aggravated by fatigue. It had grown worse as he frantically dodged in and out amongst tiny islets. His once smooth, dynamically supple hide was now a rough mass of sores. His mind felt little more agile than his body. Several times he had escaped traps that should have left him meat. Once he had fled a sonar reflection almost into Cathar John's jaws. The giant had grinned and flourished his laser rifle as Aki turned away frantically.
It hadn't been by speed or cleverness that Aki escaped. He realized that his enemy was just toying with him. He had hoped to flee northward toward Toshio's island, but now he was all turned around, and north was lost to him. Perhaps if he could wait until sunset... No, I won't last that long. It's time to end it. The chilling hunt scream pealed out again. The ululation seemed to coagulate the water around him. A large part of Aki's fatigue had come from the involuntary terror that cry sent through him. What devil was it that chased him? A little while ago, he thought he had distantly heard another cry. It sounded like a Terciop search call, but he was probably imagining things. Whatever was going on back at Streaker, they couldn't have spared anyone to look for him. Even if they had, how could anyone ever find him in this wide ocean? He had done Streaker one service in distracting the monster Katha John, in leading him away from where he could do worse harm. I hope Jillian and Hikahi got back and straightened things out, he thought. I'm sure they did. He took quiet breaths in the shadow of a rock cleft. Katha John knew where he was, of course. It was only a matter of time until he grew bored with the chase and came to collect his prey. I'm fading, Aki thought. I've got to finish this while there's a chance to win something from it, even if it's just the honor of choosing my own time to die. He checked the charge on his harness cells. There was only enough for two good shots from his cutter torch. Those would have to be from very short range, and no doubt Katha John's rifle was almost fully charged. With his harness hands, Aki plugged his breather back over his blow mouth. 10 minutes of oxygen remained. More than enough. The high scream echoed again, chilling, taunting. All right, monster. He clenched his jaw to keep from shivering again. Hold your horses. I'm coming. Chapter 74 Kipiru. Kipiru raced to the northeast toward the battle sounds he had heard during the night. He swam hard and fast at the surface, arching and thrusting to drive through the water. He cursed at the drag of his harness, but to drop it was unthinkable. Once again, he cursed the damnable luck. Both his and Moki's sleds were used up, worthless, and had to be left behind. As he entered the maze of tiny islands, he heard the hunt scream clearly for the first time. Until now, he could tell himself he was imagining things. That distance or some strange refraction in the water had tricked him into hearing what could not be. The screeching cry pealed out, reflecting from the metal mounds. Kipiru whirled, and it momentarily seemed a pack of hunters was all around him. Then came another sound, a brave and very faint skirr of distant trinary. Kipiru swung his jaw about, chose a direction, and swam for all he was worth. His muscles flexed powerfully as he streaked through the maze. When a rasping buzz told him his breather was near empty, he cursed as he popped the thing loose and continued his dash along the surface, puffing and blowing with each driving arch. He came to a narrow meeting of channels and swung about in confusion. Which way? He swiveled about until the hunt cry echoed once more. Then there was a terrible crashing sound. He heard a squeal of outrage and pain and the soft whine of a harness in operation. Another faint trinary challenge was answered by a shivering scream and another crash. Kipiru sprinted. It couldn't be far. He dashed, sparing none of his reserves, just as there came a final call of exhausted defiance. For the honor of Calathea! The voice disappeared under a scream of savage triumph. Then there was silence. It took him another 5 minutes, frantically casting about the narrow passages, to find the battleground. The taste of the water When Kipiru sped into the quiet strait, told him he was too late. He caught up short of entering a small vale between three metal mounds. Coppery strands of dangleweed floated overhead. Pink froth spread from the center of the tiny valley, with streamers of red in the direction of the prevailing currents. At the center, enmeshed in a tangle of wrecked harness parts, the body of a young amicus neofin, already partly dismembered, drifted belly up, teased and tugged at by the red jaws of a giant dolphin. A giant dolphin? How in all the time since they had left Earth had he not noticed this before? Kipiru desperately reattached a fresh breather from his harness and took gasping breaths while he watched and listened to the killer. Look at the deep countershading, he told himself. Look at the short jaw, the great teeth, the short, sharp dorsal fin. Listen to him. Gafajan grunted contentedly as he ripped a piece from Aki's side. The giant didn't even appear to notice a long burn along his left flank, or the bruise slowly spreading from the point where Aki's last desperate ramming had come home. Kipiru knew the monster was aware of him. Kathajan lazily swallowed, then rose to the surface for air. When he descended, he looked right at Kipiru. "Well, pilot," he murmured happily. Kipiru used Anglic, though the breather muffled the words. "I've just dealt with one monster, Kathajan, but your devolution fouls our entire race." Kathajan's derision was a series of high snorts. "You think I have reverted like that pathetic Steno-Smoky, don't you, pilot?" Kipiru could only shake his head, unable to bring himself to say what he thought the bosun had become. "Can a devolved dolphin speak Anglic as well as I?" Githajan sneered. "Or use logic this way? Would a reverted Tersiops, or even a pure Stenos, have pursued an air-breathing prey with such determination and satisfaction?" "True. The crisis of the last few weeks allowed something deep within me to burst free. But can you truly listen to me and then call me a devolved dolphin?" Kipiru looked at the pink froth around the giant's stubby, powerful jaws. Aki's corpse drifted away slowly with the tide. "I know what you are, Kathajan." Kipiru switched to trinary. "Cold water boils when you scream. Red-jawed hunger fills your dream. Harpoons slew the whales. The nets of Iki caught us. Yet you alone we feared at night. You alone, Orca." Kathajan's jaw gaped in satisfaction, as if he were accepting an accolade. He rose for air and returned a few meters closer to Kipiru, grinning. "I guessed the truth some time ago. I am one of the prized experiments of our beloved human patron, Ignacio Metz. That fool did one great thing for all of his stupidity. Some of the others he snuck into berths on Streaker did revert or go mad. But I am a success." "You are a calamity," Kipiru spluttered, prevented by the breather from using words more to the point. Kathajan drifted closer still, causing Kipiru to back away involuntarily. The giant stopped again. A satisfied clicking emanated from his brow. "Am I, pilot? Can you, a simple fish-eater, understand your betters? Are you worthy to judge one whose forebears were at the top of the ocean food chain, and dealt as judges of the sea with all your kind?
Kipiru was hardly listening, uncomfortably aware of the vanishing distance between himself and the monster.
You arrogate too much. You have only a few gene splices from... I am Orca!
Katha John screamed. The cry echoed like a high paean of bugles.
The superficial body is nothing. It is the brain and blood that matter. Listen to me, and dare deny what I am.
Katha John's jaw clap was like a gunshot. The hunt cry pealed forth, and Kipiru, under its direct focus, felt a deep instinct well up, a desire to tuck himself inward, to hide or die. Kipiru resisted. He forced himself to assume an assertive body stance and bite out words of defiance.
You are devolved, Katha John. Worse, you are a mutant thing with no heritage at all. Metz's grafts went bad. Do you think a true orca would do what you've done? They do hunt fallow dolphins on Earth, but never when sated. The true killer whale does not kill out of spite.
Kipiru defecated and flicked it in the giant's direction with his flukes.
You are a failed experiment, Katha John. You say you're still logical, but now you have no home.
Then when my report gets back to Earth, your gene plasm will be poured into the sewers. Your line will end the way monsters end. Katha John's eyes gleamed. He swept Kipiru with sonar, as if to memorize every curve of an intended prey.
What gave you the idea you were ever going to report?
He hissed. Kipiru grinned open-mouthed. Why, the simple fact that you are a crippled, insane monster whose blunt snout couldn't stave in cardboard, whose maleness satisfies only pool gratings, bringing forth nothing but stale water. The giant screamed again, this time in rage. As Katha John charged, Kipiru whirled and darted into a side channel, fleeing just ahead of powerful jaws. Tearing himself through a thick hedge of dangleweed, Kipiru congratulated himself. By taunting Katha John into a personal vendetta, he had made the creature forget entirely about his harness and the laser rifle. Now Katha John obviously intended to kill Kipiru the way he had finished off Aki. Kipiru fled a bare body length ahead of the mutant. So far so good, he thought, as the sparkling metal hillsides rushed past. But it proved hard to shake his pursuer. And the menacing jaws made Kipiru wonder if his strategy had been so wise after all. The chase went on and on, while the afternoon waned. As the sun set, they were at it still. In the darkness, it became purely a battle of wits and of sound. The nocturnal denizens of the archipelago fled in dismay as two swift foreign monsters streaked in and out of the inter-island channels, swerving and darting in streaming clouds of bubbles. As they swept by, they sprayed the depths and shallows with complex and confusing patterns of sound, compounded images, and vivid illusions of echoes. Local fishes, even giants, fled the area, leaving it to the battling aliens. It was an eerie game of image and shadow, of deception and sudden ambush. Kipiru slid out of a narrow, silted channel and listened. It had been an hour since he last heard the hunt scream, but that didn't mean Katha John was being silent. Kipiru built a mental map of the surrounding area from the reflections that came to him, and knew that some of those images were subtly crafted constructs. The giant was nearby,
using his immensely talented sonic organs to place an overlay of untruth over the echoes of this place. Kipiru wished he could see, but the midnight clouds cast everything into darkness. Only faintly phosphorescent plants illuminated the seascape. He rose to the surface for breath and looked at the faint, silvery underlining of the clouds. In a dismal, gloomy drizzle, the vegetation on the hulking metal mounds swished and swayed. Kipiru took 7 breaths, then descended again. Down below was where the battle would be settled. Phantoms swam through the open channels. A false echo seemed to present an opening directly to the north, the direction Kipiru had been trying to lead the chase. But on careful examination, he concluded it was an illusion. Another such fake passage earlier had fooled him, until at the last moment he had swerved away, too late to keep from slamming into the vine-covered verge of a metal mound. Battered, he had fought free of the tangle just in time to escape a ramming. Kathajan's giant muzzle missed him by inches. As he fled, Kipiru was struck by a grazing bolt from the laser rifle. It had seared a hot burn into his left side, hurting like bloody hell. Only his greater maneuverability had enabled him to escape that time, to find a refuge and ride out waves of pain. He could probably elude the pseudo-orca in time, but time was not on his side. Kathajan had dedicated himself to a ritual hunt and spared no thought for anything beyond it. He did not plan to return to civilization. All he had to do was to prevent Kipiru from reporting back and trust Ignacio Metz to protect his birthright back on Earth. Kipiru, though, had responsibilities, and Streaker wouldn't wait for him if she got a chance to flee. Still, he thought, am I really trying all that hard to get away? He frowned and shook his head. 2 hours ago, he had been almost sure he had lost Kathajan. Instead of making good his escape, he had turned around under some rationalization he couldn't even remember now, until he picked up the giant sound scent again. His enemy felt him, too. In moments, the hunt scream pealed forth, and the mutant was after him again. Why did I do that? An idea glimmered for a moment. The truth. But Kipiru thrust it aside. Kathajan was coming. He barely noticed the thrill of adrenaline that overcame the pain of his bruises and burns. The illusions vanished like an unraveling bank of fog, dissolving into constituent clicks and whispers. In a swirl of powerful fluke strokes, the giant entered the channel below Kipiru. The white countershading of the sport's belly showed against the gloom as Kathajan rose for air, then swam past Kipiru's niche, casting pulse beams of search sonar in front of him. Kipiru waited until the monster had passed, then rose to the surface himself. He blew softly 5 times, then sank without moving a fin. The monster was 10 meters away. Kipiru made no sound as Kathajan ascended and blew again. But as the Stenos descended, Kipiru aimed a tight burst of clicks to carom off 2 metal mounds across the channel. The semi-orca swerved quickly and dashed to Kipiru's left, passing almost beneath him, chasing the illusion. Like a diving missile, Kipiru dropped, nose first, toward his enemy. The hunter's senses were incredible. For all of Kipiru's unnatural quiet, Kathajan heard something behind him and swiveled like a dervish to come upright in the water, half-facing Kipiru. The angle was suddenly wrong for a ramming or raking. The laser rifle swung toward him, and the giant jaws, to abort and flee would invite a total blast. Kipiru had a sudden flash of memory. He remembered his tactics instructor at the academy lecturing about the benefits of surprise. It's the one unique weapon in our arsenal, as sentient earthlings, that others cannot duplicate.
Kipiru accelerated and pulled up in front of Kafa John, coming belly to belly with the astonished creature. He grinned. Who can deny an attentive suitor? Let's dance. Kipiru's harness whined, and the three Waldo arms snapped out to grab Kafa John's and lock them into place. The stunned ex-bosun screamed in rage and snapped his jaws at Kipiru, but he couldn't bend far enough. He tried to lash out with his massive flukes, but Kipiru's tail flexed back and forth with his adversaries in perfect rhythm. Kipiru felt an erection begin and encouraged it. In adolescent erotic play between young male dolphins, the dominant one usually took the male role. He prodded Katha John and elicited a howl of dismay. The giant writhed and shook. He bucked and kicked, then sped off in a random direction, filling the waters with his ululation. Kipiru held on tightly, knowing what Katha John's next tactic would be. The semi-orca sped slantwise toward a steep-sided metal mound. Kipiru held still until Katha John was just about to slam into the wall with him in between. Suddenly he arched and swung his weight to one side in a savage jerk. A giant he might be, but Katha John was no true orca. Kipiru weighed enough to swing them about just before the collision. Katha John's right flank hit the wall of rugged metal coral, and bloody streaks of blubber were left behind. Katha John swam on, shaking his head dizzily and leaving behind a bloody cloud. For the moment, the monster seemed to lose interest in anything except air as he rose to the surface and blew. I'll be needing air very shortly, Kipiru realized. But now's the time to strike. He tried to pull back to bring his short-range cutting torch into play. It was caught, locked into Katha John's harness rack. Kipiru tugged, but it wouldn't come loose. Katha John eyed him.
Your turn, little porp, he grinned. You set me off there, but now all I have to do is keep you underwater. It will be interesting to listen to you beg for air.
Kipiru wanted to curse, but he needed to save his strength. He struggled to force Katha John over onto his back so he could reach the surface a bare meter away, but the half-orca was ready and stopped his every move. Think, Kipiru told himself. I've got to think. If only I knew Kanik better. If only... His lungs burned. Almost he gave vent to a primal distress call. He recalled the last time he had been tempted by Primal. He replayed Toshio's voice, patron chiding, then patron soothing. He remembered his private vow to die before sinking to the animal level ever again. Of course. I am an idiotic, overrated fish. Why didn't I think? First, he sent a neural command jettisoning the torch. It was useless anyway. Then he set his harness arms in motion. Those who choose reversion's patterns need not space, nor a spacer's tools. With one claw, he seized the neural link in the side of Katha John's head. The monster's eyes widened, but before he could do a thing, Kipiru wrenched the plug free, making sure to cause the maximum amount of pain and damage. While his enemy screamed, he ripped the cable out of its housing, rendering the harness permanently useless. Katha John's harness arms, which had been pulsing under his, went dead. The tiny whine of the laser rifle was silenced. Katha John howled and thrashed. Kipiru gasped for breath as the mutant's bucking brought them both briefly out of the water in a great leap. They crashed back underwater as he transferred his grip on Katha John's harness. He held on with two Waldo arms. Coochie coo, he crooned, as he brought the other into play, ready to tear into his enemy. But in a writhing body twist, Katha John managed to fling him away. Kipiru sailed through the air to land with a great splash on the other side of a narrow mud bank. Puffing, they eyed each other across the tiny shoals. Then Cathajan clapped his jaws and moved to find a way around the barrier. The chase was on again.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 9, Startide Rising, Cassette 10.
All subtlety went out of the fight with the coming of dawn. There were no more delicate sonic deceptions, no tasteful taunts. Cathajan chased Kipiru with awesome single-mindedness. Exhaustion seemed to hold no meaning to the monster. Blood loss only seemed to feed his rage. Kipiru dodged through the narrow channels, some as shallow as 12 inches, trying to run the wounded pseudo-orca ragged before he himself collapsed. Kipiru no longer thought of getting away. This was a battle that could only end in victory or death. But there seemed no limit to Cathajan's stamina. The hunt scream echoed through the shallows. The monster was casting about, a few channels over.
Pilot, why do you fight? You know I have the food chain on my side.
Kipiru blinked. How could Cathajan bring religion into this? Prior to uplift, the concept of the food chain as a mystical hierarchy had been central to cetacean morality, to the temporal portion of the whale dream. Kipiru broadcast omnidirectionally. Cathajan, you're insane. Just because Metz stuffed your zygote with a few mini-orca genes, that doesn't give you the right to eat anybody. In the old days, humans used to wonder why dolphins and many whales remained friendly to man after experiencing wholesale slaughter at his hands. Humans began to understand, a little, when they first tried to house orcas and dolphins next to each other at ocean parks, and discovered, to their amazement, that the dolphins would leap over barriers to be with the killer whales, so long as the orcas weren't hungry. In primal, a cetacean did not blame a member of another race for killing him, not when that other race was higher on the food chain. For centuries, cetaceans simply assumed that man was at the topmost rung, and begrudged only the most senseless of his killing sprees. It was a code of honor, which, when humans learned about it, made most of them more, not less, ashamed of what had been done. Kipiru slid out into the open channel to change his location, certain that Cathajan had taken a fix from that last exchange. There was something familiar about this area. Kipiru couldn't pin it down, something to the taste of the water. It had the flavor of stale dolphin death. Eating, eaten, biting, bitten, repay the sea, come and feed me. Too close. Cathajan's voice was much too near, chanting religious blasphemies. Kipiru headed for a crevice to take cover, and stopped suddenly as the death taste became suddenly overpowering. He nosed in slowly and halted when he saw the skeleton suspended in the weeds.
Hist, he sighed.
The dolphin spacer had been missing since that first day when the wave had stranded Hikahi, and he had behaved like such a fool. The body had been picked clean by scavengers. The cause of death was not apparent.
I know where I am,
Kipiru thought. At that moment, the hunt scream pealed again, close, very close. He whirled and darted back into the channel, saw a flash of movement, and dove out of the way even as a monstrous form plunged past him. He was knocked spinning by a whack from the giant's flukes. Kipiru arched and darted away, though his side hurt as if a rib was broken. He called out, "After me, reverted scoundrel! I know, now it's time to feed you!" Cathajan roared in answer and charged after him. A body length ahead, now two, now a half, Kipiru knew he only had moments. The gaping jaws were right behind him. "It's near here," he thought. "It's got to be." Then he saw another crevice and knew. Gapanjan roared when he saw that Kipiru was trapped against the island.
"Slow, slow, or fast, fast. Time to feed me. Feed me."
"I'll feed you," Kipiru gasped as he dove into the narrow-walled canyon. On all sides, a dangling weed bobbed as if tugged by the tide.
"Trapped, trapped. I have you."
Gapanjan squawked in surprise. Kipiru shot to the surface of the crevice, struggling to reach the top before vines closed in around him. He surfaced and blew, inhaling heavily and clinging close to the wall. Nearby, the water churned and frothed. Kipiru watched and listened in awe as Gapanjan struggled alone, without harness or any aid, tearing great ropes of the killer weed with his jaws, thrashing as strand after strand fell over his great body. Kipiru was busy as well. He forced himself to remain calm and use his harness. The strong claws of his Waldo arm snapped the strands that grabbed at him. He recited his multiplication tables in order to stay in Anglic thought patterns, dealing with the vines one at a time. The half-orca's struggle sent geysers of seawater and torn vegetation into the sky. The surface of the water soon became a beaten green and pink froth. The hunt scream filled the cavern with defiance. Minutes passed. The ropes that attempted to seize Kipiru grew fewer and fewer. More and more descended to fall upon the struggling giant. The hunt scream came again, weaker, still defiant, but desperate now. Kipiru watched and listened as the battle began to subside. A strange sadness filled him, as if he almost regretted the end. "I told you I would feed you." He sang softly to the dying creature below. "But I did not say who I would feed you to." Chapter 75 Hikahi. Since nightfall, she had hunted for the refugees, first slowly and cautiously, then with growing desperation. There came a point when she threw caution away and began broadcasting a sonar beacon for them to home in on. Nothing. There were Fen out there, but they ignored her totally. Only after entering the maze did she get a good fix on the sound. Then she realized that one of the Fen was desperately crazy, and that both were engaged in ritual combat, closing out all the universe until the battle was over. Of all the things that could have happened, this stunned Hikahi most of all. Ritual combat? Here? What did this have to do with the silence from Streaker? She had an uneasy feeling that this ritual battle was to the death. Hikahi set the sonar on automatic and let the skiff guide itself. She napped, letting one hemisphere and then the other go into alpha state as the little ship slid through the narrow channels, always headed northeastward. She snapped out of a snooze to the sound of a loud buzzer. The skiff was stopped. Her instrument showed traces of cetacean movement just beyond a sheer shelf of metallic rock, heading slowly westward. Hikahi activated the hydrophones. "Whoever you are," her voice boomed through the water, "come out at once." It was a faint query sound, a weary, confused whistle.
"This way, idiot! Follow my voice!"
Something moved out from a broad channel between islands. She snapped on the skiff's spotlights. A gray dolphin blinked back in the sharp glare.
"Kipiru!" Hikahi gasped.
The pilot's body was a mass of bruises, and one side bore a savage burn. but he smiled nevertheless. Ah, the gentle rains, dear lady, for you to come and rescue me. The smile faded like a quenched fire, and his eyes rolled. Then, on pure instinct, his half-unconscious body rose to the surface to drift until she came for him. Part 8. The Trojan Seahorse. Ebony half-moons that soar from pools where the half-light begins to set, when, on what far shore, dolphins, dolphins? Hamish McLaren. Chapter 76. Galactics. Bei Chuhuan cursed the parsimony of her superiors. If the Cynthian High Command had sent a mothership to observe the Battle of the Fanatics, she might have been able to approach the war zone in a flitter, a vessel too small to be detected. As it was, she had been compelled to use a starship large enough to travel through transfer points and hyperspace, too small to defend itself adequately, and too large to sneak past the combatants. She almost fired upon the tiny globe that nosed around the asteroid that sheltered her ship. Just in time, she recognized the little Wazoon-piloted probe. He pressed a stud to open a docking port, but the Wazoon hung back, sending a frantic series of tight laser pulses. "Your position discovered," it flashed. "Enemy missiles closing." Bei uttered her vilest damnations. Every time she almost got close enough to cast a message through the jamming to the Earthlings, she had to flee from some random paranoid tentacle of battle. "Come in quickly and dock." She tapped out a command to the Wazoon. Too many of the little loyal clients had died for her already. "Negative. Flee, Bei. Wazoo 2 will distract." Bei snarled at the disobedience. The three Wazoon, who remained on the shelf to her left, cringed and blinked their large eyes at her. The scout globe sped off into the night. Bei closed the port and fired up her engines. Carefully, she weaved her way through the lanes between chunks of primordial stone, away from the area of danger. Too late, she thought, as she glanced at the threat board. The missiles were closing too fast. A sudden glare from behind told of the fate of the little Wazoon. Bei's whiskered upper lip curled as she contemplated a suitable way to get even with the fanatics, if she ever got a chance. Then the missiles arrived, and she was suddenly too busy even for nasty, pleasant thoughts. She blasted two missiles to vapor with her particle gun. Two others fired back. Their beams were barely refracted by her shields. "Ah, Earthlings," she contemplated. "You'll not even know I was ever here. For all you know, you have been forsaken by all the universe. But don't let that stop you, Wolflings. Fight on. Snarl at your pursuers. And when all your weapons fail, bite them." Bei destroyed four more missiles before one managed to explode close by, sending her broken ship spinning, burning, into the dusty galactic dark. Chapter 77. Toshio. The night blew wet with scattered blustery sheets of rain. Glossy broadleaf plants waved uncertainly under contrary gusts from a wind that seemed unable to decide on the direction. The dripping foliage glistened when two of Kithrop's nearby tiny moons shone briefly through the clouds. At the far southern end of the island, a crude thatch covering allowed rain to seep through in slow trickles. It dripped onto the finely pitted hull of a small spaceship. The water formed small meniscus pools atop the gently curving metal surface, then ran off in little rivulets. The tappity-tap of the heavy raindrops hitting the thatch was joined by a steady patter as streams of runoff poured onto smashed mud and vegetation beneath the cylindrical flying machine. The trickles sluiced over stubby stasis flanges and sent jagged trails over the forward viewports, dark and clear in the intermittent moonlight. Trails penetrated the narrow cracks around the aft airlock, using the straight channels to pour dribbling streams onto the muddy ground. There came a tiny mechanical hiss, barely louder than the rainfall. The cracks around the airlock widened almost imperceptibly. Neighboring streams merged to fill the new crevices. A pool began to form in a dirt basin below the hatch. The doorway cracked a little farther. More trickles merged to pour in, as if seeking to enter the ship. All at once a gurgling stream poured from the bottom of the crack. The flow became a gushing waterfall. Then, just as abruptly, the torrent subsided. The armored hatch slid open with a muted sigh. Rain sent a flurry of slanting droplets pelting into the opening. A dark, helmeted figure stood in the threshold, ignoring the onslaught. It turned to look left and right, then stepped out and splashed in the puddle. The hatch shut again with a whine and a small click. The figure bent into the wind, searching in the darkness for a trail. Denny sat up suddenly at the sound of wet footsteps. With her hand at her breast, she whispered, "Tosho?" The tent's fly was pushed aside, and the flap zipped open. For a moment a dark shape loomed. Then a quiet voice whispered, "Yeah, it's me." Denny's rapid pulse subsided. "I was afraid it was somebody else." "Who'd you expect, Charlie Dart? Come out of his tent to ravish you, or better yet, one of the Kiqui?" He teased her gently, but could not hide the tension in his voice. He shrugged out of his dry suit and helmet, which he hung on a peg by the opening. In his underwear, Toshio crawled over to his own sleeping bag and slid in. "Where have you been?" "Nowhere. Go back to sleep, Denny." The rain pattered on the fly in an uneven tattoo. She remained sitting up, looking at him in the faint light from the opening. She could see little more than the whites of his eyes, staring straight up at nothing.
"Please, Tosh, tell me. When I woke up and you weren't in your sleeping bag..."
Her voice trailed off as he turned to look back at her. The difference that had grown in Toshio Iwishaka the last week or so was never more manifest than in his narrowed expression, than his slitted intensity in his eyes. She heard him sigh finally. "All right, Denny. I was just over at the longboat. I snuck inside and had a look around." Denny's pulse sped again. He started to speak, stopped, then finally said,
"Wasn't that dangerous? I mean, there's no telling how Takata Jim might react, especially if he really is a traitor."
Toshio shrugged.
"There was something I had to find out." "But how could you get in and out without being caught?"
Toshio rolled over onto one elbow. She saw a brief flash of white as he smiled slightly.
"A middy sometimes knows things even the engineering officers never find out, Denny. Especially when it comes to hiding places aboard ship. When off-duty time comes, there's always a pilot or a lieutenant around thinking up homework for idle hands and fins. Always just a little more astrogation or protocol to study, for instance. Naki and I used to grab sack time in the hold of the longboat. We learned how to open the locks without it flashing on the control room."
Denny shook her head.
"I'm glad you didn't tell me you were going after all. I would have died of worry."
Toshio frowned. Now Denny was beginning to sound like his mother again. She still wasn't happy about having to leave while he stayed behind. Toshio hoped she wouldn't take this opportunity to bring up the subject again. Denny lay down and faced him, using her arms as a pillow. She thought for a moment, then whispered,
"What did you find out?"
Toshio closed his eyes.
"You might as well know," he said. "I want you to tell Jillian in case I can't get through to her in the morning. I found out what Takata Jim is doing with those bombs he took from Charlie. He's converting them to fuel for the longboat."
Denny blinked.
But what can we do about it?"
"I don't know. I'm not even sure we have to do anything about it. After all, in a couple of weeks, his accumulators would be recharged enough to lift off anyway. Maybe Jillian doesn't care. On the other hand, it might be darn important. I still haven't figured it all out yet. I may have to do something pretty drastic."
He had seen the partially dismantled bombs through the thick window of the security door to the longboat specimen lab. Getting to them would be considerably more difficult than simply sneaking back aboard.
"Whatever happens," he tried to reassure her, "I'm sure it will be all right. You just make certain your notes are all packed properly in the morning. That data on the Kikwi is the second most important thing to come out of this crazy odyssey, and it's got to get back, okay?"
"Sure, Tosh."
He let gravity pull him over onto his back, closed his eyes, and breathed slowly to feign sleep.
"Toshio?"
The young man sighed.
"Yes, Den. It's about South. He's only leaving to escort me. Otherwise, I think you'd have a mutiny on your hands."
"I know. He wants to stay and listen to those underground voices of his."
Toshio rubbed his eyes, wondering why Denny was keeping him awake with all this. He already had listened to Saud's importunities.
"Don't shrug them off like that, Tosh. He says Krydike listened to them too, and that he had to cut the channel to break the captain out of a trance. The sounds were so fascinating."
"The captain is a brain-damaged cripple."
The words were bitter.
"And Sout is an egocentric, unstable—"
"I used to think so, too," Denny interrupted. "He used to scare me, until I learned he was really quite sweet and harmless. But even if we could suppose the two Fen were having hallucinations, there's the stuff I've been finding out about the metal mounds."
"Mm-hmm,"
Toshio commented sleepily.
"What is it? More about the metal mounds being alive?"
Denny winced a little at his mild disparagement.
"Yes, and the weird eco-niche of the drill trees. Toshio, I did an analysis on my pocket comp, and there's only one possible solution. The drill tree shafts are part of the life cycle of one organism, an organism that lives part of its life cycle above the surface as a superficially simple coral colony, and later falls into the pit prepared for it.
All that clever adaptation and energy expended to dig a grave for itself?"
Toshio cut in.
"No, not a grave, a channel. A metal mound is only the beginning of this creature's life cycle, the larval stage. Its destiny as an adult form lies below, below the shallow crust of the planet, where convective veins of magma can provide all the energy a metallo-organic life form might ever need."
Toshio tried earnestly to pay attention, but his thoughts kept drifting. To bombs, to traitors, to worry over Aki, his missing comrade, and to a man somewhere far to the north who deserved to have someone waiting for him if, when, he finally returned to his island launching point.
"Only thing wrong is, there's no way I see that such a life form could have evolved. There's no sign of intermediate forms, no mention of any possible precursors in the old library records on Kithrop, and this is certainly unique enough a life form to merit mention."
"Mm-hmm."
Denny looked over at Toshio. His arm was over his eyes, and he breathed slowly, as if drifting off into slumber. but she saw a fine vein on his temple pulse rapidly, and his other fist clenched at even intervals. She lay there, watching him in the dimness. She wanted to shake him and make him listen to her. "Why am I pestering him like this?" she suddenly asked herself. "Sure, the stuff's important, but it's all intellectual, and Toshio's got our corner of the world on his shoulders. He's so young, yet he's carrying a fighting man's load now. How do I feel about that?" A queasy stomach told her. "I'm pestering him because I want attention." "I want his attention," she corrected. "In my clumsy way, I've been trying to give him opportunities to..." Nervously, she faced her own foolishness. "If I, the older one, can get my signals this crossed, I can hardly expect him to figure out the cues," she realized at last. Her hand reached out. It stopped just short of the glossy black hair that lay in long wet strands over his temples. Trembling, she looked again at her feelings and saw only fear of rejection holding her back. As if on a will of its own, her hand moved to touch the soft stubble on Toshio's cheek. The youth started and turned to look at her wide-eyed. "Toshio," she swallowed. "I'm cold." Chapter 78 Tom Orley. When there came a moment of relative calm, Tom made a mental note. "Remind me next time," he told himself, "not to go around kicking hornets' nests." He sucked on one end of the makeshift breathing tube. The other end protruded from the surface of a tiny opening in the weedscape. Fortunately, he didn't have to pull in quite so much air this time to supplement what his mask provided. There was more dissolved oxygen in this area. Battle beams sizzled overhead again, and weak cries carried to him from the miniature war going on above. Twice the water trembled from nearby explosions. "At least this time I don't have to worry about being baked by the near misses," he consoled himself. "All these stragglers have are hand weapons." Tom smiled at that irony. All they had were hand weapons. He had picked off two of the Tandu in that first ambush before they could snap up their particle guns to fire back. More importantly, he managed to wing the shaggy Episiarch before diving headfirst into a hole in the weeds. He had cut it close. One near miss had left second-degree burns on the sole of his bare left foot. In that last instant, he glimpsed the Episiarch rearing in outrage, a nimbus of unreality coruscating like a fiery halo around its head. Tom thought he momentarily saw stars through that wavering brilliance. The Tandu flailed to stay upon their wildly bucking causeway. That probably was what spoiled their much vaunted aim and accounted for his still being alive. As he had expected, the Tandu's vengeance hunt had led them westward. He popped up from time to time to keep their interest keen with brief enfilades of needles. Then, as he swam between openings in the weedscape, the battle seemed to take off without him. He heard sounds of combat and knew his pursuers had come into contact with another party of E.T. stragglers. Tom had left then, underwater, in search of other mischief to do. The battle noise drifted away from his present position. From his brief glimpse an hour ago, this particular skirmish seemed to involve a half-dozen Gubru and three battered, balloon-tired rover machines of some type. Tom hadn't been able to tell if they were robots or crude, but they had seemed unable to adapt to the tricky surface for all of their firepower. He listened for a minute, then coiled his tube and put it away in his waistband. He rose quietly to the surface of the tiny pool and risked lifting his eyes to the level of the interwoven loops of weed. In his mosquito raids, he had moved ever toward the eggshell wreck. Now he saw that it was only a few hundred meters away. two smoking ruins told of the fate of the wheeled machines. As he watched, first one, then the other, slowly sank out of sight. Three slime-covered Gubru, apparently the last of their party, struggled over the morass toward the floating ship. Their feathers were plastered against their slender, hawk-beaked bodies. They looked desperately unhappy. Tom rose up and saw flashes of more fighting to the south. 3 hours before, a small Soro scout ship had come diving in, strafing all in sight, until a Delta-wing Tandu atmospheric fighter swooped out of the clouds to intercept it. They blasted away at each other, harassed by small arms fire from below, until they finally collided in a fiery explosion, falling to the sea in a tangled heap. About an hour later, the story had repeated itself. This time, the participants were a lumbering Thaka rescue tender and a battered spear ship of the Brothers of the Night. Their wreckage joined the smoky ruins, which slowly subsided in every direction. No food, no place to hide, and the only race of fanatics I really want to see is the one not represented out here in this dribble-drabble charnel house. The message bomb pressed under his waistband. Again, he wished he knew whether or not to use it. Jillian has to be worried by now, he thought. Thank God, at least she's safe. And the battle's still going on. That means there's still time. We've still got a chance. Yes, and dolphins like to go for long walks along the beach. Ah, well, let's see if there's some more trouble I can cause. Chapter 79 Galactics. The Soro, Krat, cursed at the strategy schematic. Her clients took the precaution of backing away while she vented her anger by tearing great rips out of the Vletor cushion. Four ships lost, to only one by the Tandu. The recent battle had been a disaster. And meanwhile, the sideshow down at the planet's surface was bleeding away her small support craft in ones and twos. It seemed that tiny remnants of all of the defeated fleets, stragglers that had hidden out on moons or planetoids, must have decided the Earthlings were hiding near that volcano down in Kithrop's mid-northern latitudes. Why did they think that? Because surely nobody would be fighting over nothing at all, would they? The skirmish had a momentum all its own by now. Who would have thought that the defeated alliances would have hidden away so much firepower for one last desperate attempt at the prize? Krat's mating claw flexed in wrath. She couldn't afford to ignore the possibility that they were right. What if the distress call had indeed emanated from the Earthling ship? No doubt this was some sort of fiendish human distraction, but she could not risk the chance that the fugitives actually were there.
"Have the Thenanen called yet?" she snapped.
A peal from the communications section bowed quickly and answered,
"Not yet, Fleet Mother, though they have pulled away from their Tandu allies. We expect to hear from Buault soon."
Krat nodded curtly.
"Let me know the very instant."
The peel assented hurriedly and backed away. Krat went back to considering her options. Finally, it came down to deciding which damaged and nearly useless vessel she could spare from the coming battle for one more foray to the planet's surface. Briefly, she toyed with the idea of sending a Thenanen ship, once the upcoming alliance against the now preeminent Tandu was consummated. But then she decided that would be unwise. Best to keep the priggish, sanctimonious Thenanen up here, where she could keep her eyes on them. She would choose one of her own small cripples to go. Krat contemplated the mental image of the Earthlings, dough-skinned, spindly, shaggy-maned humans, who were sneakiness embodied, and their weird, squawking, handless dolphin clients. "When they are finally mine," she thought, I will make them regret the trouble they are causing me.
Chapter 80 The Journal of Gillian Baskin. We've arrived. For the last 4 hours, I've been the matriarch of a madhouse. Thank heaven for Hannes and Tisht and Lucky Ka and all the beautiful, competent Fen we've missed for so long. I hadn't realized until we arrived just how many of the best had been sent ahead to prepare our new home. There was an ecstatic reunion. Fen dashed about bumping each other and making a racket that I kept telling myself the Galactics couldn't really hear. The only pall came when we thought about the absent members of our crew, the 6 missing Fen, including Hikahi, Aki, and Kipiru, and Tom, of course. It wasn't until later that we discovered that Krydike was gone also. After a brief celebration, we got to work. Lucky Ka took the helm, almost as sure and steady as Kipiru would have been, and piloted Streaker along a set of guide rails into the cavity of the Thenanin wreck. Giant clamps came down and girdled Streaker, almost making her part of the outer shell. It's a snug fit. Tex immediately started integrating the sensors and tuning the impedances of the stasis flanges. The thrusters are already aligned. Carefully disguised weapons ports have been opened in case we have to fight. What an undertaking. I never would have thought it possible. I can't believe the Galactics will expect anything like this. Tom's imagination is astounding. Only we would hear his signal. I've asked Toshio to send Denny and Sao here by sled. If they take a direct route at top speed, they should arrive in a little over a day. It'll take that long, at least, to finish setting up here. It really is vital we get Denny's notes and plasma samples. If Hikahi reports in, I'll ask her to stop at the island for the Kikui emissaries. Second only to our need to escape with our data is our duty to the little amphibians, to save them from indenture to some crazy race of galactic patrons. Toshio chose to stay to keep an eye on Takata Jim and Metz, and to meet Tom should he show up. I think he added that last part, knowing it would make it impossible for me to refuse. Of course, I knew he'd make the offer. I was counting on it. It only makes me feel worse, using him to keep Takata Jim in check. Even if our ex-vice captain disappoints me and behaves himself, I don't know how Toshio's to get back here in time, especially if we have to take off in a hurry. I'm learning what they mean by the agony of command. I had to pretend shocked surprise when Toshio told me about the mini-bombs Charlie Dart stole out of the armory. Toshio offered to try to get them back from Takata Jim, but I'd forbidden it. I told him we'd take our chances. I couldn't take him into my confidence. Toshio is a bright young man, but he has no poker face. I think I have things timed right. If only I were certain. The damn Nis is calling me again. This time I'll go see what it wants. Oh, Tom, would you, if you were here, have misplaced an entire ship's captain? How can I forgive myself for letting Krydike go out there alone? He seemed to be doing so well, though. What an Ifni's crapshoot went wrong. Chapter 81 Charles Dart. Early in the morning, he was at his console at the water's edge, happily conversing with his new robot. It was already down a kilometer, planting tiny detectors in the drill tree shaft wall along the way. Charles Dart mumbled cheerfully. In a few hours he would have it down as deep as the old one, the next to worthless probe he had abandoned. Then, after a few more tests to verify his theories about local crustal formations, he could start finding out about bigger questions, like what Kithrop, the planet, was like.
Nobody but nobody could stop him now. He remembered the years he had spent in California, in Chile, in Italy, studying earthquakes as they happened, working with some of the greatest minds in geophysical science. It had been exciting. Still, after a few years, he had begun to realize that something was wrong. He had been admitted into all the right professional societies. His papers were greeted with both high praise and occasional vehement rejection, both reactions far preferred by any decent scientist over yawns. There was no lack of prestigious job offers. But there came a time when he suddenly wondered where the students were. Why didn't graduate students seek him out as an advisor? He saw his colleagues besieged by eager applicants for research assistantships. Yet in spite of his list of publications, his widely known and controversial theories, only the second-raters came to him, students searching more for grant support than a mentor. None of the bright young Mels and Femmes sought him out as an academic patron. Of course, there had been a couple of minor cases in which his temper had gotten the better of him, and one or two of his students had departed acrimoniously, but that couldn't account for the doldrums in the pedagogical side of his career, could it? Slowly, he came to think that it must be something else, something racial. Dart had always held himself aloof from the uplift obsession of many chimps, either the fastidious respectfulness of the majority toward humans, or the sulking resentfulness of a small but vocal minority. A couple of years ago, he began paying attention, however. Soon, he had a theory. The students were avoiding him because he was a chimpanzee. It had stunned him. For 3 solid months, he dropped everything to study the problem. He read the protocols governing humanity's patronhood over his race, and grew outraged over the ultimate authority mankind held over his species. Until that is, he read about uplift practice in the galaxy at large. Then he learned that no other patron gave a 400-year-old client race seats on its high councils, as mankind did. Charles Dart was confused, but then he thought about that word, gave. He read about humanity's age-old racial struggles. Had it really been less than half a millennium since humans contrived gigantic, fatuous lies about each other simply because of pigment shades, and killed millions because they believed their own lies? He learned a new word, tokenism, and felt a burning shame. That was when he volunteered for a deep space mission, determined not to return without proof of his academic prowess, his skill as a scientist, on a par with any human. Alas, that he had been assigned to Streaker, a ship filled with squeaking dolphins and water. To top it off, that smugpot Ignacio Metz immediately started treating him like another of his unfinished experimental half-breeds. He'd learned to live with that, even cozied up with Metz. He would bear anything until the results from Kithrop were announced. Then they'll stand up as Charles Dart enters rooms. The bright young human students will come to him. They'll all see that he, at least, is no token. Charlie's deep thoughts were interrupted by sounds from the forest nearby. He hurriedly slapped the cover plate over a set of controls in a lower corner of his console. He was taking no chances with anyone finding out about the secret part of his experiment. Denny Sudman and Toshio Iwashika emerged from the village trail, talking in low voices, carrying small bundles. Charlie busied himself with detailed commands to the robot, but cast a surreptitious eye toward the humans, wondering if they suspected anything. But no, they were too much into each other, touching, caressing, murmuring. Charlie snorted under his breath at the human preoccupation with sex, day in, day out, but he grinned and waved when they glanced his way. They don't suspect a thing, he congratulated himself, as they waved back, then turned to their own concerns. How lucky for me they're in love.
This ends side one of cassette 10. Cassette 10, side two.
I still want to stay. What if Jillian's wrong? What if Takata Jim finishes converting the bombs early?
Toshio shrugged.
I still have something he needs.
He glanced down at the second of two sleds in the pool, the one that had belonged to Tom Orley.
Takata Jim won't take off without it.
Exactly!
Denny was emphatic.
He'll need that radio, or the ETs would blast him to bits before he could negotiate. But you'll be all alone. That fin is dangerous.
That's just one of many reasons I'm sending you away right now.
Is this the big macho Mel talking?
Denny tried sarcasm, but was unable to put much bite into it.
No, Toshio shook his head. This is your military commander talking, and that's that. Now, let's get these last samples loaded. I'll escort you and Saud a few miles before we say goodbye.
He bent over to pick up one of the parcels, but before he touched it, he felt a hand in the small of his back. A sharp push threw him off balance, flailing.
Denny!
He caught a glimpse of her, grinning devilishly. At the last moment, his left hand darted out and caught hers. Her laughter turned into a shriek as he dragged her after him into the water. They came up spluttering between the sleds. Denny cried out in triumph as she grabbed the top of his head with both hands and dunked him. Then she leapt half out of the water as something goosed her from behind.
Toshio,
she accused.
That wasn't me.
He caught his breath and backed out of arm's reach.
It must have been your other lover.
My... Oh, no! Saud!
Denny whirled around, searching and kicking, then whooped as something got her from behind again.
Do you scrotum brain males ever think of anything else?
A mottled gray dolphin's head broached the surface nearby. The breather wrapped over his blowmouth only muted his chattering laughter slightly. Long before humans rode out on logs, we made an invention. Care to manage a try at ménage à trois? He leered, and Toshio had to laugh as Denny blushed. That only sent her splashing water at him until he swam over and pinned her arms against one of the sleds. To stop her imprecations, he kissed her. Her lips bore the desperate tang of Kithrop as she kissed him back. Saut sidled up alongside them and nibbled their legs softly, with jagged, sharp teeth.
You know, we're not supposed to expose ourselves to this stuff if we can help it,
Toshio told her as they held each other.
You shouldn't have done that.
Denny shook her head, then buried her face in his shoulder to hide it.
Who are we fooling, Tosh?
He mumbled.
Why worry about slow metal poisoning? We'll be dead long before our gums start to turn blue.
Aw, Denny, that's nuts.
He sought words to comfort her, but found that all he could do was hold her close as the dolphin wrapped himself around them both. A few minutes later, a comm alert buzzed. Stout went over to the unit on Orley's sled, the one connected by monofilament cable to Streaker's old position. He listened to a brief burst of primitive clicks, then squawked quickly in reply. He rose high in the water, popping his breather loose.
It's for you, Toshio.
Toshio didn't bother asking if it was important. Over that line, it had to be. And gently he disengaged from Denny.
You finish packing. I'll be back right away to help.
She nodded, rubbing her eyes.
Stay with her a while, will you, Saud?
He asked as he swam over to the comm unit. The steno shook his head.
I would gladly, Toshio. It's my turn to amuse the lady. Unfortunately, you need me here to translate.
Toshio looked at him uncomprehendingly.
It is the captain,
Saut informed him.
Krydike wants to talk to both of us. Then he wants us to help him get in touch with the techno-inhabitants of this world.
Krydike? Calling here? But Jillian said he was missing.
Toshio's brow furrowed as the rest of Saut's sentence sunk in.
Techno? He wants to talk to the Kikri?
Saut grinned.
No, sir. They hardly qualify, fearless military leader. Our captain wants to talk with my voices. He wants to talk to those who dwell below.
Chapter 82 Tom Orley. The brother of 12 shadows piped softly. His pleasure spread through the waters around him, below the carpet of weeds. He swam away from the side of the ambush, the faint thrashing sounds of victims dying down behind him. The darkness beneath the weeds didn't bother him. Never would absence of light displease a brother of the night.
Brother of the dim gloom, he hissed, do you rejoice as I do?
From somewhere to his left, amongst the dangling sea vines, came a jubilant reply.
I rejoice, senior brother. That group of Paha warriors shall never again kneel before perverted sorrow females, thank the ancient warlords.
We shall thank them in person,
brother of 12 shadows answered,
when we learn the location of their returning fleet from the half-sentient earthers. For now, thank our long-deceased night hunter patrons who made us such formidable fighters.
I thank their spirits, senior brother.
They swam on, separated by the 60 body lengths demanded by underwater skirmish doctrine. The pattern was inconvenient with all these weeds about, and the water echoed strangely. But doctrine was doctrine, as unquestionable as instinct. Senior brother listened until the last weak struggles of the drowning Paha ceased. Now he and his fellow would swim toward one of the floating wrecks, where more victims surely awaited. It was like picking fruits from a tree. Even powerful warriors such as the Tandu were reduced to floundering dolts on this carpet of noxious weeds. But not the brothers of the night. Adaptable, mutable, they swam below, wreaking havoc where it could be wrought. His gill slits pulsed, sucking the metal tangy water through. The brother of 12 shadows detected a patch of slightly higher oxygen content and took a slight detour to pass through it. Keeping to doctrine was important, surely, but here underwater, what could harm them? There was suddenly a flurry of crashing sounds to his left, a brief cry, and then silence.
Lesser brother, what was that disturbance?
He called in the direction his surviving partner had been. But speech carried poorly underwater. He waited with growing anxiety.
Brother of the dim gloom?
He dove beneath a cluster of hanging tendrils, holding a flechette gun in each of his 4 tool hands. What down here could have overcome so formidable a fighter as his lesser brother? Surely none of the patrons or clients he knew of could do such a thing. A robot should have caused his metal detectors to go off. It suddenly occurred to him that the half-sentient dolphins they sought might be dangerous in water. But no, dolphins were air breathers, and they were large. He swept the area around him and heard no likely reflections. The eldest brother, who commanded the remnants of their flotilla from a cave on a small moon, had concluded that the Earthlings were not here in this northern sea, but he had sent a small vessel to harass and observe. The 2 brothers in the water were all that survived, but everything they had seen confirmed the quarry wasn't here. The brother of 12 Shadows quickly skirted the edge of an open pool. Had his younger brother strayed into the open and been blasted by a walker above? He swam toward a faint sound, weapons ready. In the darkness, he sensed a bulky body up ahead. He chirped out and concentrated on the complex echoes. The returning sounds showed only one large creature in the vicinity, still and silent. He swam forward, took hold of it, and mourned. Water pulsed through his gill slits, and he cried out, "I am going to avenge you, brother. I am going to slay all in this sea who think. I am going to bring darkness upon all who hope. I am going to—" There came a loud splash. He let out a brief irk as something heavy fell from above onto his right side and wrapped long legs and arms around him. As the brother of 12 Shadows struggled, he realized in stupefaction that his enemy was a human, a half-sentient, frail-skinned, wolfling human. "Before you do all those other things, here's one thing you'll do first," the voice rasped in Galactic 10, just behind his hearing organs. The brother wailed. Something fiery, sharp pierced his throat near the dorsal nerve cord. He heard his enemy say, almost sympathetically, "You are going to die." Chapter 83. Jillian.
"All I can tell you, Jillian Baskin, is that he knew how to find me. He came here aboard a walker and spoke to me from the hallway."
"Krydike was here?"
"Tom and I figured he'd deduced we had a private high-level computer, but the location should have been impossible."
"I was not terribly surprised, Dr. Baskin,"
the NIS machine interrupted, covering the impoliteness with a soothing pattern of abstract images.
"The captain clearly knows his ship. I had expected him to guess my location."
Jillian sat by the door and shook her head.
"I should have come when you first signaled for me. I might have been able to stop him from leaving."
"It is not your fault," the machine answered with uncharacteristic sensitivity. "I would have made the request more demanding if I thought the situation urgent."
"Oh, sure," Jillian was sarcastic. "It's not urgent when a valuable fleet officer succumbs to pressure atavism and gets lost in a deadly alien wilderness."
The patterns danced.
"You are mistaken. Captain Krydike has not fallen prey to reversion schizophrenia."
"How would you know?" Jillian said hotly. "Over a third of the crew of this vessel have shown signs since the ambush at Morgren, including all but a few of the Stenos craft at Fen. How can you say Krydike hasn't reverted after all he's suffered? How can he practice Kanink when he can't even talk?"
The Nis answered calmly.
"He came here seeking specific information. He knew I had access not only to Streaker's micro-branch library, but the more complete one taken from the Thenanin wreck. He could not tell me what it was he wanted to know, but we found a way to get across the speech barrier."
"How?"
Jillian was fascinated in spite of her anger and guilt.
"By pictograms, visual and sound pictures of alternate choices, which I presented to him quite rapidly. He made quick yes or no sounds to tell when I was getting, as you humans say, hotter or colder. Before long, he was leading me, making associations I had not even begun to consider."
"Like what?"
The light motes sparkled.
"Like the way many of the mysteries regarding this unique world seem to come together. The strangely long time this planet has lain fallow since its last tenants
became degenerate and settled here to die. The unnatural ecological niche of the so-called drill tree mounds. Sounds, strange voices from the depths. Dolphins of South's temperament are always hearing voices, Jillian sighed. And don't forget, he's another of those experimental Stenos. I'm sure some of them were passed into this crew without the normal stress tests.
After a short pause, the machine answered matter-of-factly,
"There is evidence, Dr. Baskin. Apparently Dr. Ignacio Metz is a representative of an impatient faction at the Center for Uplift."
Jillian stood up.
"Uplift? Damn it, I know what Metz did. You think I'm blind? I've lost several dear friends and irreplaceable crewmates because of his crazy scheme. Oh, he hot-tested his sports all right, and some of the new models failed under pressure. But all that's finished. What does Uplift have to do with voices from below, or drill tree mounds, or the history of Kithrop, or our friendly cadaver Herbie, for that matter? What does any of it have to do with rescuing our lost people and getting away from here?"
Her heart raced, and Jillian found that her fists were clenched.
"Dr. Baskin," the Nis replied smoothly, "that was exactly what I asked your Captain Krydike. When he put the pieces together for me, I too realized that Uplift is not an irrelevant question here. It is the only question. Here at Kithrop, all that is good and evil about this several billion-year-old system is represented. It is almost as if the very basis of galactic society has been placed on trial."
Jillian blinked at the abstract images.
"How ironic," the disembodied voice went on, "that the question rests with you humans, the first sophant race in eons to claim evolved intelligence. Your discovery in the so-called Shallow Cluster may result in a war that fills the five galaxies, or it may fade away like so many other chimerical crises. But what is done here on Kithrop will become a legend. All of the elements are there. And legends have a tendency to affect events long after wars are forgotten."
Jillian stared at the hologram for a long moment. Then she shook her head.
"Will you please tell me what the bloody damn hell you are talking about?"
Chapter 84 Ikahi, Kipiru.
"We must hurry," the pilot insisted.
Kipiru lay strapped to a portadock. Catheters and tubes ran from the webbing that kept him suspended above the water's surface. The sound of the skiff's engines filled the tiny chamber.
"You must relax," Ikahi soothed. "The autopilot is in charge now. We're going as fast as we can underwater. We should be there very soon."
Ikahi was still somewhat numbed by the news about Krydike and shaken by Takata Jim's treachery. But over it all, she could not bring herself to accept Kipiru's frantic urgency. He was obviously driven by his devotion to Jillian Baskin and wanted to return to her aid instantly, if possible. Ikahi looked at things from another perspective. She knew Jillian probably already had things well under control back at the ship. Compared with the disaster she had been fantasizing the last few days, the news seemed almost buoyant. Even Krydike's injury could not suppress Ikahi's relief that Streaker survived intact. Her harness whined. With one Waldo hand, she touched a control to give Kipiru a mild soporific.
"Now I want you to sleep," she told him. "You must regain your strength. Consider that an order, if
As you say, I am now acting captain.
Kipiru's eyes began to recess. The lids drooped together slowly.
I'm sorry, sir. I guess I'm not much more logical than Moki. I'm always causing trouble.
His speech slurred as the drug took hold. Hikaki swam almost underneath the drowsy pilot and sighed a brief, soft lullaby. Dream Defender, dream of those who love you and bless your courage. Chapter 85. Jillian.
You're saying these Krank were the last Sophants to have license to the planet Kithrop 100 million years ago?
Correct, the Nis machine replied. They were savagely abused by their patrons, mutated far beyond the degree allowed by the codes. According to the Thenanin battleship's library, it caused quite a scandal at the time. In compensation, the Krank were released from their indenture as clients and granted a world suited to their needs, one with low potential for developing pre-sentience. Water worlds make good retirement homes for that reason. Few pre-sophants ever arise on such planets. The Kikui seem to be an exception.
Jillian paced the sloping ceiling of the lopsided room. An occasional clanking, transmitted by the metal walls, told of the final fittings being made to secure Streaker into the Trojan Seahorse.
You aren't saying the Kikui have anything to do with these ancient...
No, they appear to be a genuine find, and a major reason why you should endeavor to escape this trap and return to Earth with what you have learned.
Jillian smiled ironically.
Thanks, we'll do our best. So, what was done to the Krank?
She did her best with the double glottal stop.
To make them want to hide away on Kithrop, never to associate with galactic culture again.
The Nis explained.
In their pre-sentient form, they were mole-like creatures on a metal-rich world like this one. They had carbon-oxygen metabolisms, such as yours, but they were excellent diggers.
Let me guess. They were bred as miners to extract ores on metal-poor worlds.
It would be cheaper to import and breed Krank diggers than ship large quantities of metals across interstellar space.
A very good guess, Dr. Baskin. The client Krank were indeed transformed into miners, and in the process converted to a metabolism extracting energy directly from radioactives. Their patrons thought it would help serve as an incentive.
Jillian whistled.
Such a drastic shift in their structure couldn't have been successful. If me, they must have suffered.
It was a perversion, the Nis agreed. When it was discovered, the Krank were freed and offered recompense. But after a few millennia trying to adapt to standard starfaring life, they chose to retire to Kithrop. This planet was ceded them for the duration of their race. No one expected them to survive for long. Instead of dying out, however, they seem to have continued to modify themselves on their own. They appear to have adopted a lifestyle unique in known space.
Jillian brought together the threads of the earlier part of the conversation and made an inference. Her eyes widened.
You mean to tell me the metal mounds are larvae of an intelligent life form which dwells in the crust of this planet?
Yes.
I might have surmised this from the latest data sent by Dr. Denny Sudman, but Krydike had leapt to the conclusion before we even heard from her. That is why he came to see me, to get confirmation of his hypothesis.
Sounds, voices, Jillian whispered. They're Kerrang!
An acceptable tentative deduction, the Nis approved. It would have been the discovery of the century, were it not for the other things you've already turned up on this expedition. I believe you humans have an old expression in English. It doesn't rain, but it pours. It's quaint, but apropos.
Jillian wasn't listening.
The bombs!
She slapped her forehead.
I beg your pardon?
I let Charlie Dart steal some low-yield bombs from our armory. I knew Takata Jim would confiscate them and begin transforming them into fuel. It was part of a plan I had cooked up, but...
You assumed Takata Jim would confiscate all of the bombs?
Yes. I was going to call him up and tip him off if he overlooked them, but he was quite efficient and discovered them right away. I had to lie to Toshio about it, but that couldn't be helped.
If all went according to plan, I do not see the problem.
The problem is that Takata Jim may not have seized all of the bombs. It never occurred to me that Charlie could harm living Sophants if he still had one. Now, though, I've got to get in touch with Toshio at once.
Can it wait a few minutes? Takata Jim probably was thorough, and there is another matter I wish to discuss with you.
No, you don't understand. Toshio's about to sabotage his comm set. It's part of my plan. If there's even a chance Charlie's got a bomb, we have to find out quickly.
The holo patterns were agitated.
I'll make the connection at once, the Nis announced. It will take me a few moments to worm through Streaker's comm system without being detected. Stand by.
Jillian paced the sloping floor, hoping they would be in time. Chapter 86 Toshio. Toshio finished the rewiring, slapped the cover over the transmitter on Thomas Orley's sled, and spread a light smear of mud on the plate to make it seem long unopened. Then he unhitched the monofilament line from the unit, tied a small red marker ribbon to the end, and let the almost invisible fiber drift down into the depths. Now he was out of touch with Streaker. It made him feel more alone than ever, even lonelier than when Denny and Stout had departed early in the morning. He hoped Takata Jim would follow orders and wait here until Streaker left. If he did, Jillian would call down as they blasted away and warn him of the modifications that had been made to the longboat and this transmitter. But what if Takata Jim were indeed a traitor? What if he took off early? Charles Dart would probably be aboard then, as well as Ignacio Metz, 3 Stenos, and perhaps 3 or 4 Kikui. Toshio wished none of them harm. It was an agonizing choice. He looked up and saw Charles Dart happily muttering to himself as he played with his new robot. Toshio shook his head, glad that the chimp at least was happy. He slid into the water and swam over to his own sled. He had jettisoned its tiny radio an hour ago. He strapped himself in and turned on the motors. He still had to make one more splice below the island. The old robot, the damaged probe Charles Dart had abandoned down near the bottom of the drill tree shaft, had one last customer. Krydike, hanging around Streaker's old site, still wanted to talk to Sout's voices. Toshio figured he owed the captain the favor, even if he did feel like he was humoring a delusion. As the sled sank, Toshio thought about the rest of his job here, the things he might have to do before he could leave.
Let Tom Orley be waiting for me when I come back up, he wished fervently. That would solve everything. Let Mr. Orley be finished with his job up in the north and land up there while I'm below. Toshio smiled ironically. And while you're at it, Ifni, why not throw in a giant fleet of good guys to clear the skies of baddies, hmm? He descended down the narrow shaft into the gloom. Chapter 87 Jillian.
Drat! Triple hell! The line's dead! Toshio's already cut it!
Don't be overly alarmed, the Nis spoke reassuringly. It is quite likely that Takata Jim confiscated all of the bombs. Did not Midshipman Iwashika report that he saw several being dismantled for fuel, as you expected?
Yes, and I told him not to worry about it, but it never occurred to me to ask him to count them. I was caught up in the minutiae of moving the ship, and I didn't think Charlie would do any real harm, even if by some chance he managed to keep one.
Now, of course, we know better. Jillian looked up, wondering if the Timbrimey machine was being tactful or obliquely sarcastic. Well, he said, what's done is done. Whatever happens can't affect us here. I just hope we don't add a crime against a sentient race to our dubious record on this voyage. She sighed.
Now, will you tell me again how all this is going to become some sort of legend?
Chapter 88 Toshio. The connection was made. Now Kraidaiki could listen to the underground sounds to his heart's content. Toshio let the monofilament drop into the mud. He emptied ballast, and the sled rose in a spiral toward the drill tree shaft. When he surfaced, Toshio knew at once that something had changed. The second sled, the one belonging to Tom Orley, had been dragged up the steep embankment and lay on the sward to the south of the pool. Wires dangled from an open section in the control panel. Charles Dart squatted by the water's edge. The chimp leaned forward with his finger to his lips. Toshio cut the motors and loosened his straps. He sat up and looked about the clearing, but saw only the waving forest fronds. Charlie said in a guttural whisper,
I think Takata Jim and Metz are planning to take off soon, Toshio, with or without me.
Dart looked confused, as if dazed by the foolishness of the idea. Toshio kept his expression guarded.
What makes you think that, Dr. Dart?
As soon as you went down, two of Takata Jim's Stenos came to take that sled's radio. Also, when you were below, they tested the engines. They sounded kind of ragged at first, but they're working on them now. I think now they don't even care if you report back anymore.
Toshio heard a soft growling sound to the south, a low whine that rose and fell unevenly. A rustle of movement to the north caught his eye. He saw Ignacio Metz hurrying southward down the forest trail, carrying bundles of records. Behind him trooped four sturdy Kikwi volunteers from the village. Their air sacs were puffed up proudly, but they obviously did not like approaching the rough engine noises. They carried crude bundles in front of them. From the foliage, several dozen pairs of wide eyes watched the procession nervously. Toshio listened to the sound of the engines, and wondered how much time was left. Takata Jim had finished recycling the bombs sooner than expected. Perhaps they had underestimated the Dolphin Lieutenant. How much else had he jury-rigged to make the longboat serviceable ahead of schedule? Should I try to delay their takeoff? If I stay any longer, it's unlikely I'd ever reach Streaker in time. What about you, Dr. Dart? Are you ready to finish up and hop aboard when Takata Jim calls? Dart glanced to his console. He shook his head.
I need another 6 hours,
he grumbled.
Maybe we've got a common interest in delaying the longboat taking off. You got any ideas?
Toshio considered. Well, this is it, isn't it? This is where you decide. Leave now if you plan to go at all. Toshio exhaled deeply. Ah, well.
If I think of a way to delay them for a while, Dr. Dart, will you help me? It may be a little risky.
Dart shrugged.
All I'm doing right now is waiting for my bot to dig into the crust to bury an instrument. I'm free until then. What do I have to do?
Toshio unhooked the monofilament feeder coil from his sled and cut the free end.
Well, for starters, I think we'll need someone to climb some trees.
Charlie grimaced.
Stereotypes,
he muttered to himself.
All the time getting trapped by stereotypes.
This ends side 2 of cassette 10.